Israel continues its operations into southern Lebanon.
The Israeli army has informed civilian residents of another, I believe, 25 villages in southern Lebanon to evacuate.
While U.S. President Joe Biden warns Israel against actions that could threaten broadening the conflict.
We'll be discussing with the Israelis what they're going to do, but they have, all seven of us agree that they have a right to respond, but they should respond in proportion.
In Europe, Russia launches overnight attacks targeting multiple Ukrainian regions.
Kharkiv actually remains under very intense attacks by Russian forces with different kind of weapons.
And Nigeria has started a nationwide initiative for blood donations. Today is Thursday, October 3rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Miller. Israel's military has said it has killed 15 Hezbollah militants in South Lebanon on Thursday, as well as bombing Beirut after its forces suffered their deadliest day on the Lebanese front in a year of clashes with the Iranian-backed group. It comes after Iran fired more than 180 missiles into Israel on Tuesday. Earlier, I caught up with VOA's Ricky Rosen outside Tel Aviv over WhatsApp to learn more about the ongoing incursion.
The Israeli army has informed civilian residents of another, I believe, 25 villages in southern Lebanon to evacuate, to refrain from traveling south of the Litani River, and in fact, to relocate north of the Litani River because they are engaging in airstrikes, intensive airstrikes, as well as what the army is calling limited ground operations to find Hezbollah command centers that are embedded within these villages, and rocket launchers, and carry out more assassinations of Hezbollah figures. And they're trying to minimize the civilian casualties, they say, by informing them to go north. They have even announced that they will target Nabatea, which is north of the Litani River, but is within the Hezbollah realm of command.
And not only areas in southern Lebanon, Israeli forces are continuing to strike in Beirut itself.
Right. And they also struck near Damascus, and they struck a crossing between Syria and Lebanon that is considered a civilian crossing for civilian traffic. But since other crossings through which arms have been shipped and transferred from Syria, from Iran through Syria into Lebanon, and the Israeli Air Force bombed those crossings, now there is intelligence that armaments have been being transferred through this civilian crossing. And so the Israeli army is also attacking that crossing.
Thank you for that. There's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about, because on Thursday morning, D.C. time, the Israeli government released information that some 3 months ago it had killed Rahi Mashtaha, the head of the Hamas government in Gaza. For our listeners, who was Mashtaha?
Well, it was just announced now because it was just confirmed. Which I gather means that soldiers operating in northern Gaza, where he was killed 3 months ago, found his remains and those of the two other senior Hamas officials who were killed together with him. He was considered the most senior figure in the Hamas political wing inside Gaza. Haniyeh, who Israel assassinated in Tehran in the end of July, was the senior Hamas political figure outside of Gaza. He was a very close associate of Sinwar. They were in Israeli prison together. They were released from the Israeli prison together in in the Gilad Shalit hostage deal. And he was active with Sinwar in going in what they called the Internal Security Service, which went after Hamas members who were suspected of collaborating with Israel. And he was considered, together with Sinwar, to be a very brutal figure, even towards his own people. And he was said to be running, since the beginning of the war, running the government activities, the more civilian government activities, if you will, throughout Gaza.
Ricky Rosen reports for VOA from outside Tel Aviv, Israel. Ricky, thank you very much for your reporting today.
Thank you.
In addition, Lebanon's Iran-backed Hezbollah group on Thursday said it was targeting Israel's Sakhnin base for military industries in Haifa Bay with a salvo of rockets. On Wednesday afternoon, Israel and Iran threatened one another with retaliation if attacked as the United Nations Security Council met amid fears of a wider war in the Middle East. Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Dannon, called for international action against Iran following Tuesday's attack.
Let me be clear. Israel will defend itself. We will act. And let me assure you, the consequences Iran will face for their actions will be far greater than they could ever have imagined. Now the world must step up. Iran must pay a heavy price for this attack. Anything less is complicity.
Syed Erivani is Iran's UN ambassador to the UN, and he pushed back, asserting his country had been pursuing peace.
Experience has proven that Israeli only understands the language of force. Diplomacy has repeatedly failed, as Israeli views restraint not as a gesture of goodwill, but as a weakness to exploit. Each act of restraint taken by Iran has only emboldened Israel to commit even greater crimes and more acts of aggression.
But Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, sharply criticized Iran's actions.
I can think of no starker example of state support of terrorism than launching ballistic missiles to avenge the death of a terrorist leader. It is indefensible and it is unacceptable. And we have a collective responsibility as members of the Security Council to impose additional sanctions on the IRGC for supporting terrorism and for flaunting so many of this council's resolutions.
Now, over the past year, the Security Council has adopted four resolutions on the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. The most recent was in June, when it backed a ceasefire proposal outlined by U.S. President Joe Biden. VOA White House bureau chief Patsy Wiedeke-Swaro takes things from here with a look at the potential for further escalation and the possibility of U.S. direct involvement.
As Israel is preparing to strike back, President Joe Biden discussed the conflict with Group of Seven leaders Wednesday.
We'll be discussing with the Israelis what they're going to do, but all seven of us agree that they have a right to respond, but they should respond in proportion.
Biden said he does not support Israel attacking Iran's nuclear site. The U.S. president has long warned Israel not to allow its war with Hamas in Gaza to spread to Iran's other proxy Hezbollah in Lebanon and ultimately to Iran itself. Israel this week launched ground incursions into Lebanon. It has threatened strikes on Iran and other countries where Tehran's proxies are located.
This is true for Judea and Samaria. It is true for Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and it is also true for Iran. We fight the axis of evil everywhere.
Washington fears further escalation could drag the United States directly into war should Iran retaliate back against Israel, especially if American interests are hit. Former U.S. negotiator for the Middle East, Aaron David Miller, via Skype.
That would mean attacking oil-producing facilities in Saudi Arabia, for example. That could mean empowering pro-Iranian groups in Iraq and Syria to attack American forces. And yes, it could provide an avenue, a pathway for the United States to get into this war.
The U.S. is already involved in intercepting Iranian missiles targeting Israel. Whether Biden will use offensive capabilities to strike Iran directly is unclear. What is clear is that despite its calls for a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon, Washington has not succeeded in containing the conflict. Brian Katulis, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute via Skype.
The key drivers of events in the Middle East today are the players that are engaged in these combat operations. It's Israel, it's Hamas in Gaza, it's Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it's Iran and its networks across the region, including the Houthis in Yemen. The U.S. has been operating in a large to a large extent as a bystander and trying to constrain the worst outcomes and prevent the worst outcomes.
Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei blames U.S. and European countries for the wars in the Middle East.
If they rid the region of their presence, no doubt these conflicts, wars, and clashes will completely go away.
The White House has not responded to requests for comments on Khamenei's remarks, but said Tehran will be slapped with more sanctions. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And coming up later,
federal prosecutors are again trying to convince a federal judge Donald Trump is not entitled to immunity from prosecution.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Late Wednesday, officials say a Russian guided bomb struck a five-story apartment block in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, as part of a larger attack that Russian forces launched on some 15 Ukrainian regions. Anna Chernikova joins us now from Kyiv with the details.
Yes, so the city of Kharkiv actually remains under very intense attacks by Russian forces with different kind of weapons, including ballistic missiles, artillery, and guided bombs, which are used much more often now by Russian forces. And this time, it was another attack with guided bombs, and unfortunately, a residential building was under a direct hit. At this point, there is confirmation and there is footage also, which we can all see that the bomb hit the building right in the middle, and a block, a couple of blocks of the building are damaged and completely destroyed. Some of the levels, but at this point, there is information about at least 12 people injured. No people killed are reported. However, a 3-year-old child is injured and currently hospitalized. The building is at this point evacuated completely because it's not no possibility for people to stay, and the rescue operation is currently ongoing, and it might be that some people remain under the rubble. However, it's not being officially confirmed, so everyone hoped that no people would be found.
And Anna, the attacks by Russia hit numerous regions across the country, including Kyiv, where you are. What did you experience?
So attack on Kharkiv happened on the late evening on Wednesday, and over the night, in the early hours of Thursday, Russian forces launched another massive drone attack, which actually is the 33rd day in a row that Ukraine and Kyiv in particular experienced such kind of attacks. And this time, Russian forces used 105 drones, and Ukrainian air defense reported that 78 were shut down. But it was quite an active night in terms of air defense in Kyiv, particularly as the sound of explosions was heard in different districts, and in some districts, people even experience the lighting from the shutting down of drones. The debris fall also was reported in at least 5 districts in Kyiv and Kyiv region, and also later on, closer to the afternoon on Thursday, another air raid alarm was on, and a couple of other drones were reported in the Kyiv region. So at this point, the third alarm in 24 hours just went off, and while Kyiv is currently experiencing no alarm, but it was at least 3 during the day of Thursday.
And Anna, while we're on the topic of Kyiv, I understand you have a special visitor there today, Mark Rutte, the new head of NATO. What can you tell us about the visits, and was it previously announced?
Extremely important, especially for Ukraine, visit by Mark Rutte, as this is his first visit as the Secretary General of NATO. And of course, Ukraine considers this as a really great sign in terms of further cooperation between Ukraine and NATO. This visit was not announced. It was quite unexpected. Considering such a very difficult night and the beginning of Thursday, in terms of the shelling, Mark Rutte arrived just at this moment. What we know at this point is that he already met with President Zelensky, and they discussed, mainly the peace plan, the victory, so-called victory plan that President Zelensky introduced and presented in the U.S. during his visit. Also, they discussed one of the main topics was the upcoming Ramstein meeting, which is happening next week, Ukraine getting permission to use long-range missiles and long-range weapons provided by the West to use deep on the territory of Russia. These were the main topics. But also, what we know from the press conference and from what was reported, that of course, President Zelensky also discussed the possibility of Ukraine to join NATO, but he said that it's really a very tough discussion, because Ukraine remains in the full-scale war, and in general, Ukraine needs a lot to do to become a member of NATO. But this is the plan, and this is what would be this is the direction of work and cooperation that would be the priority for Ukraine and NATO.
And we'll leave things there for today. Anna, as always, we thank you for your reporting, and continue to stay safe.
Thank you, Steve.
Nigeria has started a nationwide initiative for blood donations as the country faces a huge blood shortage. Authorities say Nigeria only gets a quarter of the annual blood donations it needs, leaving both patients and hospitals in desperate need of blood in emergencies. Timothy Obizu has that story next.
Nigerian musician Excel Praiseworth has been living with sickle cell disease for 3 decades. In July, the blood disorder led to a painful health episode, and he had to get a blood transfusion.
There was no blood in the hospital. I think that their blood bank was empty. I don't even know if they had a blood bank in the first place. So we had to now start looking for blood.
Praiseworth waited more than 5 hours for a relative to donate blood and finally get him some relief. Nigeria's National Blood Service Agency said in 2023 that the country gets about 27% of the estimated 1.8 million units of blood it needs every year from voluntary blood donors. Nigerian health authorities blame the reluctance to donate blood on misinformation, cultural and religious biases, and underfunding of the National Blood Service Agency's operations, which include awareness campaigns. Nigeria's severe blood shortage often forces desperate patients to rely on so-called blood racketeers, illegal commercial donors who give blood for pay. This channel has few regulations ensuring the blood is safe for use. To help address the blood shortage, the Nigerian government announced an initiative in September to set up blood collection centers like this one across all 774 local government areas. The goal is to ensure there is enough blood for medical emergencies and transfusions. Ijoma Leonadi is the head of operations at the National Blood Service Agency.
There's this apathy about donating blood. People don't like donating blood. They feel that if they donate blood, that they might die because they don't have enough. We also go to institutions of higher learning where we have population of youths, and we go to churches. We have churches that are densely populated. We go to shopping malls, we go to markets.
Bali Kisu Muhammad is a first-time blood donor.
I think it's important because there is someone out there that needs it. So since I have enough, think I can donate.
Praiseworth is using his music to educate others about sickle cell disease and encourage people to donate blood. In 2022, he launched a nonprofit called The Sickle Sound.
And that's what I'm doing with The Sickle Sound, putting out the right information about the sickle cell disease. Once you understand how something works, then every superstition or myth you've had before, it's broken.
Leonardi says the National Blood Service Agency aims to eventually have 1 million safe blood units reserved across 6 zonal centers in the country, but she did not say when it is expected to reach that goal. Until then, many people like Praiseworth will struggle to get life-saving assistance. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Elsewhere, fear and grief are gripping a Madagascar community after deadly kidnapping sent shockwaves through an area already suffering high levels of criminal activity. Reuters' Diane Toh continues our coverage.
This community in Madagascar's Anjezoro Bay district has gathered to mourn victims of fatal kidnappings. A tragic escalation of such violence has gripped the region. Panjona Raheri Fololona was among 5 people abducted early August. Among those taken were a rice farmer, a teacher, and a recent graduate. Weeks later, when their families were unable to pay a $48,000 ransom, they were brutally murdered. Raheri Fololona's widow, Sarindra Andrea Tsarahasina, is now afraid to go to work.
My husband used to look after our children when he came back from the fields because I was working in the village. But now I don't dare leave our children. Their father is no longer there, and the lack of security makes it hard.
Madagascar is one of the world's poorest countries. The kidnappings worsen an already tense situation in an area classified as a red zone due to high levels of criminal activity. Law enforcement blamed the Dahalu, that's a name for rural bandits who have shifted from cattle rustling to human abduction, as livestock numbers in the area have declined. National police have upped their presence. But they say the vast expanse of the region poses severe challenges. 2 months since the kidnappings, the village is still gripped by grief and fear. Some farmers are scared to tend their fields. The headmaster of a local secondary school said several students have requested transfers.
The children are not the only victims. The teachers are also beginning to lose hope.
For Andrea Tsarahasina, she worries for her and her children's futures. We don't know what to do. Where to go, she says. I followed my husband here, and he is dead.
Diane Toh of Reuters. And finally, prosecutors say Donald Trump laid the groundwork to try and overturn the 2020 U.S. election even before he lost, knowingly pushing false claims of voter fraud. From the Associated Press, Sagar Magani has that story.
Federal prosecutors are again trying to convince a federal judge Donald Trump is not entitled to immunity from prosecution over his failed bid to stay in power after the 2020 election. In a court filing, they say Trump resorted to crimes after losing the race to Joe Biden. The filing by special counsel Jack Smith's team comes after a Supreme Court opinion that gave broad immunity to former presidents for official acts taken while in office. Smith's prosecutors hope to convince federal judge Tanya Chutkin that the charges against Trump are private, not official, and they should remain part of the indictment against him going forward. Sagar Magani, Washington.
We're out of time for today, but before I go, I'd like to thank you for spending part of your day with us. There, of course, is more news around the clock at voanews.com. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller. For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.